This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is novelist Rita Mae Brown, who in her life and in her novels has challenged stereotypes of straight and lesbian women. Her first novel, Ruby Fruit Jungle, was a semi-autobiographical coming-of-age story about a lesbian. After it was published in 1973 by a small feminist press, it became a cult favorite. It was one of the few novels of the time that had a lesbian heroine, and readers loved the fact that this lesbian was funny and smart and wasn't doomed to endless suffering as a consequence of her sexuality. The book broke into the mass market in 1977 when it was republished by Bantam. Brown's subsequent novels include Six of One and Southern Discomfort. Her novel Sudden Death was about a lesbian professional tennis player, which led readers to speculate about how much of the story was based on Brown's former relationship with tennis star Martina Navratilova. Brown's TV credits include the film My Two Loves about a bisexual woman. Her new novel, High Hearts, is set in the South during the Civil War. Brown lives in Charlotte, Virginia, and is absorbed in Southern history. She grew up in a poor family in rural Pennsylvania. They moved to Florida when she was 12. In the South, she participated in civil rights protests. When she moved north as a young woman, she joined the anti-war movement, then became a feminist and gay rights activist. Rita Mae Brown told me that she was expelled from college when she became involved in the civil rights movement and was accused of being a lesbian.
I was at the University of Florida because they gave me a very good scholarship. And Delta 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 took me in.
Is this sorority?
Yeah, Tri-Delta, which was wonderful because I got good meals. They needed me to raise their grade point average because Tri-Deltas are usually the beauty queens, of which I was not one. But I loved it at any rate. We had 7 black students and 14,000 white students. And the University of Florida shoved them all in one end of the dorm and then went with its hand out to the federal government and said, look, we're an integrated university. We get all kinds of federal funds because of that. Don't cut us off. And I thought that was both dishonest as well as cruel to those 7 black students. So myself and Judith Brown and the Harmeling twins, Dan and Jim, and a couple others, mostly led by the Harmeling twins, because I was only a freshman. I didn't know very much, started to make trouble. And to make a long story a little bit shorter, if I can, they revoked my scholarships. That was how they got rid of me. And one of the ways they did it was they had my sorority president call me in and ask me about hanging around on the NIGRA, N-I-G-R-A, side of town. And I didn't deny it. And she said, you know, you can't do that and be a Tri-Delta. You're going to get us into a lot of trouble. And I said, then I'm happy to get us in a lot of trouble. Feel free to throw me out of here. And she said, but the logical progression, would you want to live next to one until it gets to the point where you say, would you marry one? You know, all that sexual fear, that racial sexual fear. And I blew up. You got to remember, I was 18. I was very naive. And I said, I don't really care if somebody's black or white or a man or a woman. I just want them to love me. Are they a good person? I remember to this day what I said. And that was it. She went to the dean of women, Marna Braney, with the story that I was a rampant lesbian, which, of course, I was not. I didn't know anything at that point except that I could respond to both sexes fairly equally. But that's what they got me out on. But the whole impetus behind it was civil rights.
How did you react to the idea of everybody trying to figure out in a way which was worse, the possibility of you hanging around with black people or you being a lesbian? They were just appalled by both of them.
Lesbianism, on the surface, doesn't threaten the power structure. In those days, if you were a white Southerner and you made common cause with blacks, you threatened the power structure. So obviously, that was more difficult. But they would do anything to destroy your name. And, of course, homosexuality is seen as a great blot upon your character. Well, it still is to some people. So they made good on that threat.
You moved to New York, I guess, shortly after
that
incident.
Well, I didn't exactly move. I was driven out. I hitchhiked up.
Uh-huh.
I had $14 and I think 75 cents in my pocket and slept in a car at University in Waverly, which is right where NYU starts, Washington Square College. And I was there for 3 days until I got a job as a waitress. And in that time, I found a little kitten, a little gray tabby kitten, who I called Baby Jesus. And that was my only friend in New York. I wouldn't do it again today. I mean, part of the reason that I did it was that I was so dumb. I didn't know how dangerous it was. We're now talking about 64 and 65. Once I got a job as a waitress, I found a little cold water flat in what became the East Village. At that time, it was just Ukrainians living there. Very clean, much nicer than when it became the East Village, really. And I went to a fellow, he didn't speak very good English, but he took a chance on me. And his wife had a beautiful cat named Marushka. And I think when she saw how much I loved this little kitten, that the wife talked the husband into giving me a room without me being able to pay rent up front. But I paid him. I kept my waitress job and paid him. And I stayed on there for a couple years.
Did you go to school?
I went to NYU, and I wanted to enroll. I had no money. Of course, it's a very expensive private institution. It's still quite expensive. And I had a thick Southern accent, and they just automatically assume that you're stupid. So they made me take tests, and if there's one thing Miss Brown can do, it is test well. I test like a wizard. Of course, I know how dumb I really am, but on the page, do I ever look smart? So they gave me scholarships, and they were tuition scholarships, and they gave me a job in the library so I could stop waitressing, which was great because I'd hang out in the back stacks and read, which probably drove the librarian crazy. But that's how I got through college. And baby Jesus went to classes with me.
Really?
Yeah.
On a leash or on your shoulder?
No, she used to ride, and I used to wear an old pea jacket. It was the only thing I really had. And she'd ride in that pea jacket in the cold weather, and she'd just sit in my sweatshirts in the warm. She was a very good kitty.
Did you consider yourself a feminist at the time?
I didn't know I was. I think most Southern women are feminists. I think most women are feminists when you get right down to it. But the word scares them off. We were all in the anti-war movement at that point. The war started to heat up, and the draft got right ugly. And all the rich boys, of course, were buying their way out with these psychiatric things. They're running to Canada, and it was all the poor boys that were getting their asses shot off over there. And that meant my cousins. That meant the boys I grew up with. So I had a great stake in either making that a real war and getting it over with or pulling out. But I was one of those women who exploded at the way we were treated by the men that ran the anti-war movement. And the civil rights movement wasn't much better because in the beginning it was a good partnership between the white boys and the black men. And I emphasize white boys because they were very arrogant young men from Grosse Pointe and Brookline and Swarthmore. You know, these weren't real working class people. There were no calluses in those rooms. And they were terrifically arrogant. Well, finally, the people in the black movement had the sense to throw them out. But we were stuck with them in the anti-war movement. And that was a very ugly time. I hated every second of that, too.
So you were in conflict with a lot of the men in the anti-war movement?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were crude. I'll never forget when Elridge Cleaver was asked at Yale, what's the position of a woman in the anti-war movement and in the civil rights movement? He said, prone and parallel. And he got a huge roar of approval. And that's the day I walked. I said, yeah, right, you fight your own battle, buddy. I'm not going to fetch coffee for you anymore, and I'm going to fetch it for anybody else.
So that's when you left the anti-war movement?
I just walked. I had it with all of those boys.
Well, you joined a gay group at NYU, right?
No, I didn't join it. I started it.
You started it.
There were Martha Shelley and Steve Donaldson and I started Student Homophile League at Columbia University. This was 1968, and although I was at NYU, I would train up to Columbia. And I used to use their classics library because it was a little better than the one we had at NYU. And we started this group for homosexuals on campus, which was an absolute revolution. And in the first week of Student Homophile League, Columbia University lost $1 million in alumni funds. It made the front page of the New York Times.
Because of this group,
yeah.
They lost it?
Yeah, the old alums, we ain't sending money into those queers, you know. And the chaplain sponsored us. So this was quickly subsumed by the riots that happened within 2 months of our starting Student Homophile League. And then, really, it was tremendously exciting. I know it's almost hard for someone who didn't live through it and wasn't young to realize how exciting it was because we thought we could alter the power structure. We did, but not the way we thought we would. Well, I went back down to NYU and started a group there, which I'm happy to say is still in existence, one of the largest groups on campus, very responsible and respected by other groups, too.
I was under the understanding, though, that you left that group or at least became disillusioned with it because you thought that the gay men in the group were trying to dominate and that it was hard for the lesbians to... No?
That didn't happen to me in college. First of all, gay men are so much more obvious than gay women. I mean, I remember one meeting, there were 300 men and Martha Shelley and myself, and it didn't bother me. Mm-hmm. I was just happy to see them speaking out. But where I really ran into trouble was in the women's movement, because by now the women's movement had started, and there was Robin Morgan and T. Grace Atkinson, Flo Kennedy, and myself. Gloria didn't even come into it. Gloria Steinem didn't come into it until 5 years later. She was working at CBS at the time. So it was just a bunch of us ragtag people. And then there was Betty Friedan, who sort of represented women in their 30s and 40s, a completely different generation. So already the women's movement was divided between those of us that came out of the new left and those of us who were older and were housewives, etc. That's where I ran into big trouble.
What kind of trouble?
It was, you know, in retrospect, it's so silly. But at the time, I was always suppressed. I was never allowed to speak to the media. I was very rarely allowed to make statements in meetings. I was 22 because, well, I was young, but also because they didn't want me to raise the issue of lesbianism. They were happy to tolerate me in private, but they were not willing to acknowledge me in public. And I got really angry. I said, you are doing to me what men do to you. You know, either you have equality all across the board or you don't have it at all. And they kept saying, oh, this is going to destroy the women's movement. It's what men want to think about us anyway. And I'll never forget my response, because I still think it was correct. And I said, why do you want to seek approval from the group that is oppressing you? That makes no sense. Our common cause is with one another. Now, I have since, of course, refined that position. I do not think all men oppress all women. But this was we're talking about 20 years ago.
Well, I think that more mainstream groups like now were also concerned that mainstream women would be alienated from the movement if the movement contained lesbians in it, that they'd be scared away, and that it was like one of the big priorities of a group like now to try to bring as many women into it as possible. So what was your response to that, that, you know, your presence as a lesbian was going to alienate women who might be ready to join now, but, you know, wouldn't if they thought there were lesbians involved?
My response is true equality was worth the risk, and so is participatory democracy. And when is the last time you've heard that phrase, participatory democracy? Another phrase that shows you just what state we're in is, have you heard the phrase redistribution of income lately? we're very far away from those issues. I do understand their fear very much. I think it was ill-founded, and that it never caused the women's movement the problems they thought it would. What caused the women's movement problems were class differences between women. And I always call now what? I make fun of them. But they never acknowledged it, and they never addressed it. And at one point, the lesbians did leave the women's movement en masse. And, of course, the women's movement was on its chops in about 71 and 72. Until they realized they did have to make common cause with gay women and get over this, because the men had abandoned them. The men in the new left just literally left them out.
You were a separatist for a while. What was the thinking behind that, of you know, being in separate lesbian groups and of being separate from men and defining lesbianism as a political as well as a sexual act?
And that was one of the best things I ever did in my life. I would encourage anyone listening, if they're Jewish, if they're black, if they're Asian American, if they're a lesbian, whatever it is, to at some point in your life, even if it's just at summer camp, to go with the people who share this oppressed identity with you. Because it is an oppressed identity. You're an individual. You're so much more than the fact that you are black. You're so much more than the fact that you're a lesbian. But you're mistreated because of those factors over which you have no control. So that you need to draw sustenance from others who share a similar problem. And I spent 2 years in a separatist community, which I helped found. And I learned more in those 2 years, I think, than I did in all the years adding up to it. I learned what we really do have in common, and I learned what we don't have in common. And I learned that I am one of those people that needs to be out in the world. I have trouble. I mean, if I walk into a room and it's all white, already I'm uncomfortable. I'm a person that needs a lot of difference in my life, and I need different kinds of people. But I don't think I could have been so excited about it if I first didn't really understand what being a lesbian means in America.
Which is what?
Means a couple things. It means that you titillate men. One of two things happen. You either titillate them or you scare them so badly that they've got to attack you in a particularly personal and vicious manner. And these attacks, if the man is, shall we say, not intelligent, are crude sexual attacks, verbal. If he's intelligent, he attacks your work. You see? But they're always extremely vicious. I mean, you can tell from the level of intensity that the man is very threatened.
You think this is because lesbians represent some kind of challenge to heterosexual men?
No, not all men. But there are some men who feel that if a woman is not the private property of one man, she should be the public property of all men. I mean, there are women who want a fantasy sex relationship with every woman they meet. They want to think that if they really worked on you, they could get you in bed. What they don't realize is this is objectifying a person, that it in fact brutalizes that person. It also brutalizes themselves. How can you make any kind of emotional connection and growth if you're looking at people as objects? So I learned that. I also learned that there are a lot of men who could care less. They're willing to accept me for myself. I also learned that a lot of lesbians are frightened of, not men, because I don't think lesbians give two hangs about men, which really insults them. I mean, see, a lot of men think they're the negative center of your life if you're a lesbian. What they don't realize is that the lesbian is disinterested. A man is not a negative center at all. Her complete energy is going towards women. She doesn't care what any man does. That's not true of me. And let me try to explain that. If human sexuality is a scale of 1 to 10, and 1 is stone homosexuality and 10 is stone heterosexuality, I can't speak for you, but I am always sliding between 4 and 6, and I know it. And I'll talk about it, and I'll admit it, and I can respond to people. I can respond to men and women emotionally, and I can respond to them sexually. And I would actually feel terrible if I could not. I would hate to be trapped with just one sex, but that's me talking. I think most people are so frightened of themselves sexually that they want to either be a lesbian or they want to be a married woman. And I keep saying to people, sexuality is an ever-expanding part of your life. It's not rigid. You're always growing, and anything can happen to you if you just open. I'm not talking about promiscuity, please. I'm talking about real emotional connections to other people, which may involve sexuality.
Do you think bisexuality is a natural state?
Sure I do. For most of us, I think it is. There are a few of us that aren't, and they become completely gay or completely straight, and they usually have very pronounced behavioral patterns to manifest that. But I found that out, that a lot of lesbians were not willing to be free either. That they insisted upon a definition of being a lesbian, which usually meant you wear Birkenstock shoes and a work shirt. And I don't know about you, but I found that quite boring. See, I think women are works of art. I think a woman is always a moving sculpture. And unfortunately, men don't see men that way. I wish men would take a little more care with how they look. But I didn't want women to reject beautiful clothing and bright colors and all the things that I love. But I learned a lot. I learned that so many people who are lesbians are damaged by this system, that close off, that have to live in isolated communities. It's the only way they feel safe. They're alienated from the society. We all lose. They're not giving their best at work because they're spending some energy hiding. They're not giving their best to their families because they're spending energy hiding there. And from that experience and that terrible pain, seeing how these people suffered, I was able to realize how an Asian American might suffer, how a black might suffer. And it was through that separatist experience that I was then able to reach back out and connect to all of us who are not safely white, who are not safely heterosexual, who are not safely male, who are not safely upper middle class, which is most of America. And I feel terrible when some of those people can't connect back to me because they're still responding to the fact that they perceive me as a lesbian.
My guest is novelist Rita Mae Brown. Her new novel is titled High Hearts. One of your recent novels, Sudden Death, was set in the tennis world, and it was about a lesbian tennis player. And because of your relationship with Martina Navratilova, everybody wanted to know how biographical it was. And now that that experience is several years behind you, and she's written her book, and you wrote a novel loosely based on the experience, do you have any regrets at all that you both ended up, you know, writing books and that it became public? Because I imagine you went through a period during the relationship of trying to keep it as private as possible.
That relationship would have never been public in the way it evolved if Martina and Nancy Lieberman hadn't given a press conference in August of 1981 to say that Nancy Lieberman was making Martina straight. that she was taking her from the clutches of this terrible, I was always presented as the cosmopolitan, sophisticated, evil woman, and that Nancy was going to save her from Rita Mae. Of course, Martina had been gone since April. Why they did this in August, I don't know. And Martina, unfortunately, went along with it. I think she regrets it very much. In fact, I know she does, because she's told me so. I wish she would say it publicly, but at least she has had the courage and, in a sense, real caring to say it to me privately. But she did that, and I woke up the next morning. I didn't know they'd had a press conference. It was on the AP wires, and there were reporters all over my front lawn. I had not a clue. I called a friend of mine at the Daily Progress and said, "What happened?" The Daily Progress is our paper in Charlottesville. Well, she read me the story, and I almost died. I called my lawyer. I said, "What do I do?" And my lawyer said, "You've got one shot at it, because if you don't, they're going to plague you." He said, "You've got to give an exclusive interview to someone." I said, "Well, I'm not going to pick a reporter, because I don't think that's fair. That's like prevailing on old friendships, because I have a lot of friends in the media." So he said, "Well, then pick a newspaper you respect." So I picked the Washington Post, and they had been one of the papers that called. So I gave an interview to Stephanie Mansfield, who I'd never met. I hoped, I just prayed that she would be neutral, and she was, I think. And she wrote an article. It pained me. I hate seeing that kind of stuff in print, but I'd done it. Everybody else ran with it, just stole from her article, and they didn't bother me anymore. Sudden Death, I wrote because Judy Lacey died. And 3 days before she died, she asked me to do this book because we talked about it. We've been on the road together for a couple years. And, of course, it became my book in the writing of it. I can't pretend that it didn't. But it's not really very close to Martina and myself at all, but people chose to think that it was. They kept thinking I was Harriet, whereas actually I was much closer to a character called Lavinia Sibley Archer in terms of my ability to plan for the future. I mean, because I thought the way Lavinia thought in some ways. But Martina came back 2 years later and did apologize, and I think has grown up a lot, has been very good to me. We're in touch all the time. She always sends me goodies in the mail. We talk a lot. I think she's really happy. I think she's in a very good relationship now. And I love her like a sister. Everybody in my whole family is dead now. She's really the only person from my past that I loved. And thank God I have her. And thank God we were able to find our way back to one another as sisters.
You have recently been writing movies and television movies, and one of your television movies was on in, I guess, spring of 86. My Two Loves was on, the subject was bisexuality and lesbianism, really. And this is not a subject that television frequently has movies about. Did you have certain standards that you had to follow? Did you have to wrestle with standards and practices or anything?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Fortunately, the man that produced it, Alvin Cooperman, is probably as close to a saint as anyone's going to come in the television industry. He's a man of vast experience and has high standards of his own personal standards. So Alvin would go to bat. I didn't have to worry about the producer backing out the minute the network gave us trouble. Well, the network didn't give us trouble. Bruce Salen, who's vice president in charge of miniseries at ABC, was terrific. The problem was broadcast standards and practices. Now, think back on the television shows you have seen that have anything to do with your real life. Always in the fifth and sixth acts, the therapist appears.
That's right.
That's broadcast standards and practices makes you put a therapist in these damn things. God, I was mad about that. I guess, I don't want to stick a therapist. What's a therapist got to do? Oh, no, you've got to do it. This is the only way people can handle these kind of issues. Well, that was fight number one, and I lost that one. Fight number two was there was a kiss scene. I lost that one. That hit the cutting room floor. I mean, here you can have people in bed on Knot's Landing, but you can't have two women in bed. They can't look erotically connected. The third battle I won, which was the ending. In the original ending, she goes back to the doctor, and I wouldn't do it.
The doctor's the man.
Yes. And fortunately, Alvin didn't like it either. And I wanted her to go to the woman. And boy, they said, no, it looks like we're promoting lesbianism. It looks like we're comparing women to men. How terrible. We can't possibly tell America this. But then I thought about the character, and she'd been recently widowed, and I thought it probably made emotional sense if she didn't go to anybody. And I finally was able to win that ending, which, of course, some people have been critical about, like, why didn't she go off with the man, you know? And I say, if you only knew the battle we had to get the ending we got.
Do you feel that you've had to renounce your previous views as your views have changed since you know, you had been a separatist for a while and you'd made some pretty harsh statements about men in general. And now that you're more pluralistic and like to be with a diverse group of people, and you've made your peace with men, or at least some men, you have a lot of men friends and have had men lovers, do you feel like you've had to renounce the politics of your past, or you just see it as a natural evolution?
Well, I always saw myself as an equal opportunity offender. I think I offended women as much as I offended men. No, I don't think I've had to renounce anything. I've grown a lot. I've changed. That's part of growth. I'm excited about it. And I'm sorry that so many of us see change as a renunciation or thinking that we were wrong before. The human being goes through stages of development if you keep open to life.
Your literary success and your outspokenness have made you a kind of spokesperson. I don't know if it's a position that you wanted or not, but I know back in the 70s you wrote several articles about the difference between leaders and stars, and how mm-hmm. the media would always like pick somebody out from a movement or from the women's movement, make them into a star, and that they choose the person who they'd be most comfortable with, and that when you were a star, you're in the position of being co-opted by the media and the mainstream who appointed you to that position. How have you tried to use your kind of spokesperson type position that you've gotten by virtue, as I said, of your outspokenness and of your success as a writer?
I'm not a true spokesperson because I haven't been elected by any constituency. So I can't really speak for anybody but myself. As it turns out, it appears that millions of Americans agree with me on some issues, which is gratifying. It also turns out there are a few million that don't agree with me and that I find myself on the hot seat quite a lot. Too gay for the straight people and not gay enough for the gay ones. And the only way I can move through this, Terry, is to be true to myself. I speak from my heart. And I just hope that most people will know that, even when they do disagree with me, that at least I'm giving them honesty.
That was writer Rita Mae Brown, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Her new novel, High Hearts, is published by Bantam. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Joyce Lieberman and Audrey Voblaitis. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Sallet is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I are the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.